How much to the Buddha? How much to the Dharma? How much to the Sangha? So today I'm going to talk about the practice of brightening the body-mind. I might say just mind, but I'm going to say body-mind because it's awkward that we divide them up. Brightening the body-mind. So this means noticing when we're stuck in negativity, hopelessness, despair, discouragement, lack of confidence. It means acknowledging, okay, this is what's going on, feeling it, asking, you know, what is it that we're attached to that is causing this constriction, causing this negativity. And then finding a way to shift the state of our body-mind toward positivity, toward active hope, which I just did a series on, which is less about what you think is likely to happen and more about what you hope for and what you're going to work for. So it's kind of a focus on what are you going to do. A sense of empowerment and agency, a sense of determination. So how do we brighten the mind when it's body mind, when it's negative, and we make it more positive? And however it is that we tend to feel, whether we're feeling bright or feeling dark, we tend to think it's reality. You know, when we're feeling bright, it's like the world's a wonderful place, and when we're dark, it's just like, you know, we think it just reflects reality and not so much that it's our state of the mind. But I think this is one of the main points of Buddhism, is our mind is not just a passive mirror of reality. It's not just like, you know, we're a victim of circumstance and the world's crappy, so our mind feels crappy, or the world's wonderful, so our mind feels wonderful. It's we participate in reality. The state of our mind, our attitude, our approach is part of reality. We can influence it. So I'm going to share a personal story with this around this that is, you know, basically occurred over the last month. And I just want to say, no advice or pity is required. And I really like, I feel like that's, I hope that's the approach we take for anyone who shares something in here. When it takes some courage to say, I've been struggling with something, I've been feeling down, I've been feeling whatever, and, you know, I don't know about you. Maybe you like advice when you're not asked, when you haven't asked for it. But I know for me, it's just like, it makes me just want to shut up. It makes me want to like, no. So I feel like one of the things that we can do in Sangha and in practice is really have a sense, I trust you, I got you, I'm sure you have this. I know you're going to figure it out. I mean, we can talk about it. I might ask some questions or something like that, but I'm not going to be like, oh, well, when I figured that out, I did this, you know? So, with that said, I'm just going to be honestly sharing something that's been going on lately and then how I applied this brightening the mind practice. So, I've been feeling discouraged, and yesterday we had the one-day retreat, and I really, you know, as I sat down, I mean, I was conscious of it approaching the retreat, but certainly once I sat down for the day, it was, you know, it was just a yucky, down, irritable, discouraged kind of attitude. And there's several things that have been going on, one in particular that I'll talk about that has led to this kind of frustration and discouragement. But I think, as you're well aware, when you start to feel this way, it just colors everything. I mean, everything starts to seem just like, you know. So, you know, my dogs are getting older, getting health problems, and I just learned by the time dogs are nine or little dogs are 9 or 10, they've lost half their teeth usually. And I'm like, my little Soka losing teeth. Oh, you know, and so recently for the first time, I think I've had this sense, because I've had a lot of pets over my life, but I've never actually, except for one rat, I've never actually been with them through till the end. Like So-on just did with her parrot. 27 years she had that little buddy. And to see, and I kind of saw, because I was a little, like, I don't know, previously just like, well, I mean, love hurts, but, you know, you just love, you just embrace, and you just, you know, it's kind of a romantic thing. But I'm like, you know, this sucks. This really makes you go like, I don't know. I don't know if I want to do this again. You know, this is... To really have what you love and care about disintegrate is just like, I didn't know that it would suck that much. So anyway, there's that. Just, my parents were in town for 3 weeks, and that's lovely, but then I get behind on things, and I don't like to be behind on things, and I don't know. So, you know, it's like different aspects of my life ended up just feeling like, oh, heck. But, you know, I think at the center of it right now for me is I really do believe that we are in a climate and ecological emergency. I really do believe that. There's part of me that goes like, maybe we're wrong. Maybe it's just a delusion. Maybe it's just like, they remember how they said we were going to overpopulate the earth and all this terrible stuff was going to happen? Maybe it's just overblown. But it's like, I just repeatedly return to the evidence, the preponderance of evidence, the consensus that has really been building over the last like 30 or 40 years. And it's a huge amount of cognitive dissonance. It's just like, why are we even going about our daily lives? I just really don't. So one of the things, as some of you know, we went through this process, this class on active hope. And I mean, the idea is to basically find something to do, some response, some way to respond. And as Greta Thunberg, the Swedish climate activist, says, and other people have said, essentially, like, you, hope isn't something that you go around looking for. Hope is something that you make. When you start to act, you create hope. Okay, so it's like, I'm gonna find something to do. I've been looking and shopping around and pondering this for ages, but then Extinction Rebellion appeared about a year ago. And so this is a group that started in the UK, and, you know, it was really well thought out, and it focused on nonviolent direct action, just to pressure governments to make changes, and, you know, to tell the truth about the urgency of the emergency we're facing, to enact binding legislation to get to net zero emissions by 2025, to form citizens' assemblies to decide the course forward, because we can't trust our politicians, because they're always, you know, they owe something to somebody always, and they're thinking about their re-election, so we can't trust them to take the measures that are need to be taken. And in the U.S., we also have a fourth demand, which is that the transition be just, that it not happen on the backs of the poor or the global south or et cetera. So that's, you know, and so you're doing nonviolent direct action, and it's just clear, and it kind of, one of their phrases is like, beyond politics. So we're not getting into the details of whether you should be vegan or whether, you know, we should go to electric cars or phase out cars. All those details, which end up being divisive. It's just kind of like, we just got to take action, and they're smart people. If we listen to them, we'll be able to find a way. Just got to do it. So I don't know if any of you have read anything about this, but, you know, they've shut down London a couple times, essentially occupied bridges, and a lot of times their actions are very colorful and creative, and you know, and they have some principles that they abide by. There's actually a growing number of Buddhists that identify with Extinction Rebellion. So there's like kind of a Buddhist faction, kind of their principles of operating are actually quite compatible with our practice. So, I mean, I just like feeling more hope around this than I've felt around pretty much anything out there in the world that I've ever encountered my whole life. I've been concerned about all of this since I was old enough to understand any of it. So it's been around for about a year. I can't be involved in the Portland chapter because they meet on Tuesday nights. So I've been trying to get something started on the west side. And now it seems like before I've even really been able to be involved, particularly I have fantasy of being arrested in my priest robes, and you know, the visuals of being dragged off to jail. There were some visuals of Buddhist nuns being arrested in the UK. And before I even get to get involved, it seems like the organization is imploding. And it's very, it's getting a lot of criticism. It's getting criticism that it's not inclusive enough, that the emphasis on arrest basically means that marginalized people can't participate. It's largely white middle class, that it's not sensitive enough to and featuring the voices of people of color and marginalized people. And I think we're familiar with these refrains because they're things that are being raised in many different areas of our society right now. There's, you know, that it's not sensitive enough to the working class. There was a big hubbub because in the UK, a small faction of people, against the disagreement of others, glued themselves to a passenger train and held up the, you know, there's gorilla glue, apparently. You can just glue yourself to something, it's really hard to get you off. Apparently there's some kind of solvent or something, but like, so that's part of the action sometimes. So they glue themselves to a train, and this was in a working class area, and some people got so mad that they like dragged this guy off the train, and then like there was a scuffle, and you know, so it's kind of like, it's badly bad PR for XR, Extinction Rebellion. So, you know, and our local chapter is just, it hasn't managed to arrange many actions at all because it's just like a microcosm of this meltdown. It's just like infighting and people getting offended. And I have my West Side affinity group that was these two beautiful, sweet, gender non-binary folks that came, and they were energetic, and they were you know, open-hearted and idealistic. And just last Monday, we had this wonderful, it was a very little meeting, but we all essentially talked about our longings and our fears and our hopes that this works. And it was just like this wonderful, like, bonding meeting. And then the next night, these two people went to the Tuesday meeting in North Portland and had such a horrible, negative, traumatic experience that they want nothing more to do with XR anymore. So it's just, you know, it's like, so I was feeling discouraged. and it's this, and not just about like this particular organization, but like, come on, are we going to be able to do anything? You know, it's like the ideal versus the actual. You want to do this, and then once you get out there, it's like, oh, you know, it's like hard and slow and involves people, and I don't know. So I came to the retreat yesterday feeling, you know, negative and sad and worried. I mean, there's a aspect of certain kind of stability and peace that I found through my practice, but that doesn't make the problems of the world go away, and I care about the world. So, you know, it's not just, you know, this doesn't go away. So I did yesterday that, you know, in doing Shikantaza, as Shintai pointed out, Like, what is keeping me from sitting? What is keeping me from just sitting? And recognizing these feelings, these thoughts, and then I just sat in them for a while, just sat in them for the morning, just bleh, you know, just allowing them to be. And noticing the tendency to be thinking of all the stuff. Now, if you were at the retreat yesterday, you probably recognized that my little Dharma talks throughout were guiding you through this process, because that's what I was doing. I wasn't guiding you, I was. So I noticed the tendency to think of all the stuff I could do or change out there. Well, I could start, you know, we could start a West Side chapter. We're going to start fresh, and we could do this, and, you know, I can take care of my dogs like this. You know, it's all the stuff that I could do or change so that I'll feel better and take care of things. So that's the tendency. So, okay. And then, you know, explore it a little more deeply. Like, so what is it that is causing all of this to be so sticky? And I noticed there was a sense like these things have to work out. And, you know, I have worries around the Zen Center as well. There's not an option. It has to work out. And this is an aspect of in Buddhism where we recognize how we make things worse with attachment. So it's possible to have a very, very sincere hope and desire for us to, you know, survive as a species, and yet not be attached to the outcome. Now, this sounds like I'm saying I don't really care that much about the outcome. I'm good either way. But it's not that. It's, I like to think of attached. It's not so much about being attached to this thing as I like to think of it as like, I'm a vacuum cleaner, and I've got attachments. So I've taken this thing, I've taken this hope, and I've attached it to myself. I've made it part of who I think I am, and, you know, really, there is a big part of me that's like, I want to have something effective to do. I want to be able to do something that works. Like, it's all about me, right? It's I want to have a answer. I want to be part of the solution. So these are ways that I've taken this thing and I've attached it to myself. And that pretty much inevitably leads to suffering. So, okay, that's interesting. I see how I'm attached to these things. And we don't do this with a sense of like, ooh, there's that attachment. Get rid of it now. I mean, sometimes it falls away, sometimes it doesn't. Sometimes it's just a matter of, huh. So then, later in the retreat, okay, so I've taken stock of what's going on. I'm not going to solve these issues, at least not then and there. So then it was like, now it is time to just sit. To just, you know, let go of trying to figure these things out. Let go of trying to plan. Just sit. And I'm not talking about my just sitting, my shikantaza suddenly being like really still and profound and free of thought or anything like that. I'm just more willing, more ready, more wholehearted in that. All right, that letting go. So there was a gradual lifting of the clouds, gradual brightening of the body mind. Until, you know, around by lunchtime or so, some gratitude for being at the retreat. Enjoyed my cheese and crackers. Even was able to appreciate, like, all right, well, I'm alive to wrestle with all of these issues, you know, trying to find a way to respond to this crisis. And, you know, that's something to be grateful for. Began to feel a little more capable of facing the challenge. All right. A little more grown up and responsible. Now, the important thing is that I didn't talk myself out of the negativity. You know, so I didn't come away with my issues and concerns, you know, denied. Oh, my dogs will never get old and die. Ah, we're going to solve this climate crisis, no problem. Like, it's, no, the concerns and the issues are still there. And I'm not distracting myself in a Pollyannish way of just, let's just concentrate on the sunshine and, you know, don't think about the negative things. It's not that kind of dualism. It's like, it's acknowledging, but letting them, you know, turning the mind in a way that it's more bright and positive and capable. So when I was writing this talk, I wanted to, you know, now we're going to go a little bit more in detail over these different steps. And I thought, this is kind of like four different steps. That sounds familiar. And then I realized this is like step by step, this is like the RAIN thing, the way Tara Brach lays it out. So she's a Buddhist teacher, and I think this is a beautiful kind of, like, I have not studied or used her RAIN system of mindfulness and dealing with feelings and stuff, but it's like, she didn't just make that up, really. I mean, that was her, she has a clever, like, little acronym to remember it and teaches it, but this is very, just very Buddhist. This is just very natural to practice. So I thought that, oh, that's cool. Like, I just happened to come up with this same thing. So for her, she says, so RAIN is recognize what is happening, allow the experience to be there just as it is, investigate with interest and care, and nurture with self-compassion. And if any of you are familiar with this thing that she's slightly changed the last two in the recent years, but. So if you're at all interested in exploring this more, you can search for Brach, B-R-A-C-H, RAIN, and like her website will come up, and it has guided meditations that you can do around it. Well, let's see, first recognize. So there's just noticing what's going on with us. Our Zazen, our mindfulness helps us do that. I feel like in particular Zazen, and then if you ever have the opportunity to go to retreat, this is kind of like stopping to recognize on steroids, you know, stuff that you still, even in with daily Zazen, might be able to kind of, and you get to retreat and you don't have any distractions, and it's kind of like, oh, there's that thing. So recognize, but it also takes a willingness to admit that we don't always have things worked out. Even though we're adults, even though we're old, even though we have many years in practice, even though we're a psychologist, or even though we're a Zen teacher. So it has some courage to face our concerns and to recognize when something is challenging. Then allow, or acknowledging, taking some time to let things be, feel the sadness, pain, anger, confusion, longing. Because if this practice is just about trying to avoid painful feelings and experiences, it's just selfish. And we're just going to end up spiritually bypassing, just using our practice to try to feel better. And I mean, I try to do this. You know, I sit down if I'm feeling awful. I'm like, you know, what kind of practice, what kind of mind shift can I do? This is not going to hurt as much. You know, I mean, I want it to fix my pain. But so this is allowing that so that we don't end up doing that spiritual bypassing. We take some time to really acknowledge what's going on. Then there's investigate, as she says, asking what we're attached to. And this isn't about fixing the situation, although occasionally we might find something that we can do. But it's important not, if we go in with the agenda to fix it, then we can't see as clearly. We can't, things won't reveal themselves to us in the same way if we're like, you know, ready to pounce on a potential answer. It just opening up possibilities. you know, once I see, oh, okay, I'm attached to the outcome. I think this has to happen, and you know, and I've attached it to myself. I mean, just having seen that opens up possibilities in the future that maybe I've managed to think of things a little differently or try to mellow out a little bit about something. And then nurture, finding a way to brighten the body-mind, finding a way to shift the state of our body-mind to positivity, active hope, sense of empowerment and agency, determination. And this is, you know, this is an ancient Buddhist practice. If you read the Pali Canon, the Buddha talks about, you know, a disciple of the Buddha, you know, observes their own mind. And say, when I do this, when I think about this, this happens. And I suffer, and I'm negative, and da-da-da. When I do this, this happens. And, you know, my mind is bright, and there's some positivity, and I feel like I can let go. So these things aren't just a matter of our mental opinions or attitudes. It's you know, it's everything, you know, it's, did you get enough sleep? Are you eating? Are you exercising? Yesterday, I was like, I'm overwhelmed, I'm negative, I don't want to go to a retreat. But on the other hand, I knew that would probably be the best thing for me, that, you know, probably be the best possible thing I could do is to go to retreat. So before I close, just a note on self-compassion. So she talks about nurturing as involving this self-compassion. And when we think about being truly compassionate, for me anyway, sometimes it helps for me to think about being compassionate to someone else. When I think of being about compassionate to myself, I don't know, it gets a little confused. But if I think about being compassionate towards someone else and what that might look like, it helps. So, you know, you're a child, a family member, aging parent, friend, colleague who's asking for help, right? You're kind, you're supportive, you communicate that you care, that you have this person's well-being in mind. But compassion is not just nice. It's not just encouraging the person to crawl into bed with a good book, or treat themselves to a cruise, or tell them they're right about everything. And if they're running into problems, it's just because the world is so unfair. You know, so it's not just, as we say it when we talk about generosity, it's not just necessarily giving somebody what they want. I mean, sometimes it might just be encouragement, but, you know, that true compassion is not necessarily that, always that. So with gentleness, you might gauge, what are they ready to hear? You know, what are they, because oftentimes we have more insight into other people than they do into themselves. I mean, including, you know, goes back the other way. You can see where somebody's like, just, you know, they're kind of causing their own misery. So you kind of, you know, is there an opening here? Is there something I can say that, you know, they might be able to be ready to hear? And if the time is right, you might tell them something that's a little hard to hear. You know, have you thought about maybe, you know, your mom has a different point of view? You know, something like that, you know? Communicate to them that you think they're capable and responsible. And maybe, capable of shifting their own experience. So my example of this is, I went to go visit my friend Fushin this week, and she's in a nursing home, and she's suffering from dementia, so sometimes there's certain aspects of her reality that she's completely out of touch with, but there's certain pieces that are just right there sometimes. And so I was just telling, she can't really carry on a real conversation in the sense that usually if she's talking about her own experience, it doesn't make any sense, but she's right there when I'm telling her about mine. So I was telling her about Extinction Rebellion, and then, you know, and now there's got this criticism, and now, like, mean, this is an emergency, right? We might have 5 to 10 years, and now what are we going to have to do? We're going to solve all the social problems in the world before we move forward? Like, we're going to have to solve racism and classism and, like, you know, get rid of capitalism before we do it? You know, so I was, like, negative, and I said, and I didn't even get a chance to really be involved in this organization before it's imploding. And she listened, and she says, well, you're just going to have to see it as a positive implosion. And I was like, Well, you know, and I asked her more about what she meant. She's just like, if you can't find some verve or excitement around it, then it's not for you. Then you're not going to be able to do it. I was like, then I said, and I could see her point. Like, you know, if I'm just like, yeah, it would, is there a way that we can see this as an opportunity? It occurred to me, not right then, but it occurred to me that the frustration that I'm facing and thinking, like, come on, people, yeah, maybe you're concerned about racial justice and police brutality and the way we exploit the global South and all that, but we got to do something. And there's part of me that thought, you know, the people who have been marginalized and exploited, I don't know that they would put it this way, but I get a little bit of a sense of like, yeah, well, if this earth is going to go on, it's going to go on with justice. Otherwise, we don't give a shit. And that makes some sense to me. It's like, yeah, all right. You know, this whole thing's going to fall apart. But unless I get some justice out of this, unless you turn toward healing this whole system, then I'm not with you. So in a way, you know, it's a challenge and an opportunity to really turn toward those things, because really in the long run, that's what we're going to have to do. So, but I didn't think of it at the time. I was saying to Fushi, and I was like, well, do you have any advice, you know, about like, how would I see this as a positive implosion? And she said, I don't know. It's not my thing. This is your thing. Like, this is, you know, and I was just like, and when I left and I gave her a hug and I said, I love you, she said, are you sure? And, you know, I mean, that was like, I mean, that was compassionate. That was hopeful. And then, I mean, and we can do that for ourselves. You know, I mean, it isn't just like yesterday and like, oh, I'm feeling sad and I really want to take like the whole next week off and do nothing. I really, that's what myself wants to do, but I really can't, okay? So there's part of me that yesterday was like, all right. Did anybody say this was going to be easy? No, you know, like, come on, buck up, come on, you could do it. So brightening the body mind isn't just about making ourselves feel better, although, you know, certainly time for self-care, as we call it, but, you know, it's also about making a choice to better fulfill our bodhisattva vows. So it's not just about us, it's about being able to be a better spouse, a better teacher, a better parent, better you know, roommate or whatever it is, to be better at what we're trying to do. So I'll leave it at that. Questions or comments?
So when are you going to pick a topic that has some meat in it? Because, you know, we could spend the rest of our days together solving this existential issue. Yeah. Thank you.
You shouldn't take a week off. Why not? I think we could all do without a newsletter and a podcast for a week, right?
Well, I do have a scheduled no podcast the week after this. So maybe I'll find a way.
That's right.
Well, I mean, and actually it was Fushin when I was telling her about my podcast and stuff, and she was like, basically said, that just seems like you're working too hard. And so now I actually schedule 12 weeks off a year. So I'd make 3 podcasts and I'd take a week off. So, and that was largely I might have come to that conclusion anyway, but she was the first one to point me toward that. So next week's a podcast, but the week after that isn't.
I mean, we were talking about the storytelling aspect of when your mind gets going, you know, and this has happened to me. It actually happened to me last night because we have to get our financial information together for our health care. And, you know, I'm concerned, I'm on Medicaid right now, but we could get kicked up to Obamacare, but what's going to happen to Obamacare? And, you know, my taxes are so complicated. And I had to basically do my taxes early to figure out what am I making? Because I'm the boss lady and I'm writing checks for everybody and all this stuff. And so I've just been, you know, like this storytelling thing about, well, what's going to happen? And, you know, I'll just drive to Canada and I'll pay out of pocket and I just, I get this stuff in my inbox because I have this illness and I want to learn about it. And they're like, you know, comorbidities. I don't want comorbidities. it's just like piling up. And my husband, though, he's actually gotten pretty skillful about that, like not giving advice, but just say, well, what's funny is his advice is, maybe you should go meditate. So he's not home very often. You know, he's gone 2/3 of the time. So a lot of Sundays, you know, I'm going to spend the day with, I'm like, honey, I'm going to get up early. I'm going to shovel some oatmeal in and put my hat on. And I'm coming here. Because sitting in a group is just so, it's so beneficial. And it helps me to structure and do that. I mean, you know, there's these sayings about the different styles of Zen. There's Bompu Zen, which is just like Zen to make yourself feel better. But I think that's okay. I think there's nothing wrong with that because it is like getting enough sleep and taking your medication and whatever. It's just taking care of me. And so I was like, you know what? I'm going to get myself out of bed and come over here. And that was the most simple, best advice from him. Just, you know, you're getting wound up. Maybe you should meditate.
You know, it occurs to me that no matter how intractable we view these issues that you're talking about, and they certainly most of the time may seem intractable, we still have the freedom to make decisions about what we are going to do, including how it is that we can act to make ourselves better prepared or better people to face whatever it is that is out there. I really appreciate your sharing these things that here we are. You know, we don't know how long we're going to be around. And it seems we really need to come to a place where we find a way in which we can be active to the degree we wish and not exist totally in a dark place.
It's encouraging in a way that, you know, Buddhists are getting involved in Extinction Rebellion because, you know, we have stuff to offer on this, with this respect, you know?
I do want to say how much I appreciate your allowing us to go along on this journey that you're going on. Because for me, you're our priest and you're providing leadership, but you're going through shit. Excuse my language. And you're sharing the path. And I think maybe that's the hopeful thing for me, is that you're turning to the resources of your spiritual life and wrestling with it. And it doesn't sound easy to me at all. It sounds very painful, and certainly the Extinction Rebellion inflow is disappointing, and it's also still a story, so we don't know what will happen next and stuff. But I appreciate you taking us on your journey. Thank you.
I so want to have answers. I so want to, like, I'm a writer, right? I want to write about this stuff. But then I'm like, I can't write about it unless I have, like, something to offer, right? I don't have, write about this unless I say, but here's what we should do. Like, I don't know. Okay. And Zen and Buddhism doesn't tell you. That's not what it's for. So, yeah.
I'm also a writer, but I do think that that is the ultimate power of what we do. It's not the answers, it's the act of sharing stories. Mm-hmm. And that means everyone can be a teacher or a writer or, you know, pick a thing. But it is just the act of sharing stories and being open enough to speak your truth. Even when it's not pretty, I don't mean oversharing, but I just mean being, you know, being vulnerable in that sense. And that really is a gift, I think.
Well, I hope so. It's the gift I have to give.
It's like in AA, you know, I've been in sobriety for 18 years, and that's what people do. They get together, they get vulnerable, and share their stories. And, you know, there's people from all different backgrounds and all different places on the political spectrum and age and gender and whatever. Everybody's so different, but sharing this common experience of, you know, trying to stay focused and stay sober. Sharing common experiences. Mm-hmm. So, and I appreciate you wanting to be open about it too, because yeah, people had this idea of like the perfect guru, you know, and you know, you have to, how enlightened you are, but when you share your struggles, it really, I mean, it's like, oh wow, okay, even a professional priest has the same crap that I'm dealing with, so I'm not going to be so bad.
And there's a, you know, There's different types of, I don't know, you know, our teachers, Kyogen Gyokuko, kind of in between. If you have like a total, like, and this is why I think, you know, some religious leaders who want to maintain the era of holiness also don't try to do anything. Because when you try to do stuff, it gets messy. You know, if you just do your holy thing and pontificate from on high, then you know, if you can sound great. But if you really try to like make a sangha work, or you really try to like, you know, find a way to be active or compassionate, you know, whatever, it's so, you know, on the one hand you have people who might just put themselves like that, and on the other hand there's very down to earth. I would say Kyogen Gyokuro were somewhere in between. Definitely toward the down to earth. They weren't as self-revelatory as I am. That's just not who they were. But we have other teachers in our lineage who are. That, like, Jiko tends to be quite self-revelatory about just her struggles. And so even though Kyogen and Gyokuko didn't necessarily tell their own stories in the same way, they obviously made it okay for us to do that. They didn't say, if you're going to, you know, be a senior, you're going to be a teacher, don't talk about that stuff. People are going to lose faith in the practice, right? But that has never been my experience. Whenever I am honest about the struggles, people go, oh, this is something I can do. This is about me. This is about my life and practice. This isn't some, you know, great achievement that I will never be able to touch. This is, you know... And that's what it's like. That's what it's all about. That is about every one of us navigating our own way and learning our own minds and trying to find some peace and meaning within our own lives. So with that, I will let you go. Oh, yes, sorry. Sorry, I've had a formal end to the Dharma talks now, which I'm not used to yet. It's a good thing to do. Abiding in this ephemeral world like a lotus in muddy water, the mind is pure and goes beyond. Thus we bow to Buddha.
All the rest found space and time, all honored ones, bodhisattvas, mahasattvas, wisdom beyond wisdom, maha, prajna, paramita.